But we also proved that I'm not always nice.
But even when you're upset and even when you're ticked off, you still come from a place of compassion and love. Whereas I'm just old, bitter, and jaded.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome to the 11 o'clock hour of As Goes Wisconsin. I am your host, Kristen Bry. And as of this week, 150,000 U.S. members of the United Auto Workers Unions are going to vote on whether or not they're going to authorize a strike, which is just the latest in the summer of strikes. Obviously, we keep hearing about the WGA and the SAG strike. UPS just avoided a strike. But this is not the first time we've been talking about it. But we wanted to have a bigger discussion around why this is happening now, the zeitgeist around it, and if there is a real cultural shift happening around unions and labor. So here to talk through it with us is Michael Childers, who is the professor at the Department of Labor and Education at UW-Madison and co-chair of the University of Wisconsin's School for Workers, where he's an expert in specializing in labor unions, collective bargaining, production standards, labor and management relations. And so you're basically the guy to talk to in Wisconsin about labor and unions, it seems like.
Well, our department has five faculty members besides me. And yeah, all of us are happy to engage with the public on these topics.
So I guess, could you have predicted that this was going to happen as far as what we're seeing happen this summer of how many different industries, how many different people? Because this is also hospitality workers in California. I know in Wisconsin, there's Line and Kugel's is still, I don't think, has come to an agreement. So like, what's happening?
I think a few things. You alluded to it in terms of, I think fundamentally we could talk about how I think most people's relationship to their work got brought into pretty stark relief when we were dealing with the initial phases of the pandemic, right? Where we had most people that could work remotely switching to that. The people who couldn't, which is like, you know, somewhere between 50 and 70% of the working population, we're told you're essential workers and go out and do good things so that the rest of us can all stay at home and work. As far as like the major contracts that have come, I say another big change, Kristen, is the media is covering it more because.
Interesting.
Typically, I mean, workers have, are always, you know, trying to advocate for, you know, they're a good work life, right? Good working conditions, higher pay, et cetera. But it's kind of become a thing that the media has been more interested in. But yes, you're absolutely correct in saying that there have been several very large and very high profile negotiations occurring over the last, I guess, 12 to 18 months for that matter. Which again, gives the media something to cover, right? So.
Well, gives us something to cover. And then, does that create the chain reaction of, I think, you know, for me, I feel like when that huge, was it in Long Island or Staten Island, when Amazon, when the workers unionized in the Amazon warehouse, I forget where in New York that was, but it was such a big deal. And the guy who led it was like, you know, not a seasoned organizer, right? And it was like this huge David and Goliath story. And like, how much of those stories then motivate and inspire and spread across industries of like, well, if they can do it, maybe we can do it.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, yeah, what Chris Smalls and his group of friends were able to achieve out there when major unions were not able to achieve this, for example, in Bessemer, Alabama, there had been a large organizing drive and, you know, Amazon was found to have violated multiple labor laws. They forced a rerun of the election and the union, the workers still did not choose to unionize in their election, right? So there's no question that's an amazing story, which of course is super interesting. I would mention also in that context, especially along the lines of what you were just saying, the Starbucks workers, right? Yeah. What started with just a few baristas in Buffalo. And then we have our own Wisconsin story about this. It's Collectivo, where as the workers come together and start to talk to their coworkers and decide, yeah, you know what, we'd kind of like a say in hours, wages, and conditions of work here at our workplace. We spend a lot of waking hours here. And yeah, the mechanism for gaining that kind of input is where you have to be legally recognized by your employer as an equal at the table, right, to bargain over these things. Yeah, I think in a real sense, those workers, we told them they're essential, and they kind of took us up on it and said, well, yeah, we are essential, and we should be able to have a decent life if we choose. We want to be baristas. We want to be in the service industry, you know. We should be able to have a sustainable life. And, you know, you mentioned the L.A. Sorry, I'm going into full professor mode here.
No, this is great.
You mentioned the L.A., the hotel worker situation. And there was prior to this, kind of a precursor when the, nationwide Marriott workers went on strike. But, yeah, one of their slogans was, one job should be enough. That, you know, if we're doing work that's essential to your enterprise that allows you to continue to make money, you know, we shouldn't have to scrounge up or cobble together two or three jobs to be able to have a decent life. So.
Absolutely. And so I guess as far as being a professor of this, like when we think of like unions and like, what is the role of unions in today's day and age? And I guess like, is there, and I've asked this question before and never really, I think I asked it rhetorically because this is radio, and if you don't have a guest, there's no one to necessarily answer it. But I asked, like, is there any other mechanism that exists to secure workers' rights and balance power between the owners and workers besides creating a union?
Really, in a real sense, no. I guess the quickest way to describe it without getting too deep in the weeds is that in the United States, predominantly employment at will is the law of the land for the private sector, and for that matter, increasingly in the public sector, which means that you can be let go at any time for any reason or no reason at all. Now, don't get me wrong. We have some employment law, right? There are protected classes of workers. You can't discriminate on the basis of race, gender, et cetera, Title VII. But by and large, I mean, that isn't really very high guardrails on employers who want to be, you know, flexible, or the worker might say arbitrary and capricious. I mean, in the United States, there aren't, again, really strong employment laws like there are in most other countries in the OECD, you know, developed world countries, or even, you know, our neighbors to the north for that matter. So
I don't know if a lot of people know that. Like, it wasn't until I worked for a company that had, like, I was managing a team that had a team in Amsterdam, and like, there was a problematic person that we had to put on a performance plan and stuff like that. But like, the process of letting someone go in Europe is very different than, and that was the first time I realized that, of like, for better or for worse, because obviously I think there's like low performers and there's people who complain about how hard it is to get rid of people who are not necessarily, like, to part ways with people who are not good workers. But like, in Europe, it's a very different game as far as your protections as a worker.
Sure. And you alluded to it, and you're exactly right. That's usually one of the first things that unions will bargain for, like in a first agreement, which so far zero Starbucks locations have arrived at yet. But, and we could talk about that for a minute if you wanted to, but you exactly nailed it. I mean, it's funny because that sometimes gets thrown up as a criticism of US unions. Well, you spend a lot of time, you know, on people who maybe, you know, should be counseled into a new career, we'll say. And I'll give you the my favorite response from a union leaders that I've heard, which is, yeah, the company hired them. It's our legal obligation to represent them under the National Labor Relations Act. So we didn't hire these people. You did. We just have to fulfill our role in the process now that, yeah, we are in a unionized environment. So
we're talking to Michael Childers, who is a professor at UW-Madison and the co-chair of the University of Wisconsin School for Workers, about the environment of unions and strikers and strikes happening in across the nation, also in Wisconsin. And I guess, like, we mentioned Leinenkugel's, we've mentioned Colectivo, but quickly, I guess, do you see similar trends that are happening in Wisconsin, especially like ahead of like 2024 and things that are happening with a new Supreme Court, like Wisconsin Supreme Court, or like, what are you seeing as far as labor in Wisconsin?
I guess I would say it this way. It's not that labor has ever stopped doing this work, right? Workers, all people in general, we want to be treated with dignity and respect. And to the extent that we feel disrespected or that things are unfair, this is, as we've been talking about, the one way that you have, you know, because we talked about that our employment laws are relatively weak. But if you form a union, then you also get labor law protections. Now, don't get me wrong, in the private sector, there are some protections under the Act, the Section 7 protections, which allow workers to come together for mutual aid and support, right? So a group of workers can go to their boss and say, yeah, we don't like the schedule change you just made. You know, could you possibly change it? Or we feel like something's unsafe. And they couldn't legally be fired for that. And they would have recourse under the NLRA, even if they haven't formed a union, to you know, have their jobs reinstated in that example. But I guess I would say I think you kind of nailed it in terms that the people at Starbucks originally weren't thinking we want to organize Starbucks coast to coast. But as workers heard about it and said, well, what are they doing? How do they why couldn't we do the same thing? And I think in a real sense, that had a lot of the kind of impetus for, you know, the over 200 elections that, you know, the workers have chosen. Yeah, we want a union. We would like to bargain collectively with our employer here at Starbucks. So I think there can be some of that sort of momentum, or that workers, you know, hear about it and say, that sounds all right. How would I go about trying to get some of that? So,
yeah. Absolutely. Well, and that's kind of when we come back from the break, where I want to go, of like, what industries are ripe for unionizing? Because is there certain things like conditions or criteria of an industry where it's like a union makes sense versus when it doesn't make sense? And also, I would like to talk about like when and why they got such a bad rep, and if it's justified as far as some of those criticisms. It's a lot to fit in 8 minutes when we come back, but I think we'll do it. We're talking to Michael Childers, who is a professor at UW-Madison, about the summer of strikes. If you have any questions, feel free to text them in, 844-967-2789. This is As Goes Wisconsin. We'll be right back. Back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry, along with Jane Matinair, and we are talking to Michael Childers, who is a professor at UW-Madison and co-chair of the University of Wisconsin's School for Workers. And we're talking about unions and labor and striking. And I guess, because I think in the last couple years, there's been more unionizing in newsrooms. And so, because I think so often when we think about unions, we think about like actual labor, we think about factories, we think about the teachers union. But I guess with kind of like we said, there's all these stories of strikes happening and potential inspiration being taken from them. So are there certain criteria of an industry that makes it more or less apt for a union to form?
Well, as part of this goes back to the history of the labor movement here in our country, right? And the industries in which it was predominant. And yeah, that's, we talked about a little bit, you know, service industry jobs, and that traditionally over time, they've always been on the lower end of the economic spectrum. But when you look at it, that's, if you look at where union density has been in those industries, it has also been very low. I mean, you know, even when it reached its zenith here in the United States back in the 50s, where, you know, over one third of workers were in a union in the private sector, those were predominantly, as you said, industrial manufacturing type jobs. So as that segment of our economy and the employment in that segment has declined, those are jobs that have left our economy, which were unionized jobs, which kind of in a way explains the decline of union membership across the decades since the 1950s. I guess I'd say that as workers are starting to organize more in these other segments of the economy, and we talked about the baristas as one example, but you think about the other jobs that are still in our economy, right? The service industry is still going to always have, no matter how many self-checkouts they put in, we're still going to have some service workers where we're not all just donating our time to the companies that we're doing business with. But you think about it, it's the tech industry, right? It's and there have been some stories about this where the communication workers organized the video game testers here in Madison at Raven. And again,
I never heard about that.
Yeah, that was a pretty high profile one because, well, I mean, in a sense, because it put kind of under the microscope many of the issues that have arisen as people have tried to organize unions here in the United States. And you mentioned like newsrooms as another example. Those are jobs. Now, we could talk to WGA and SAG-AFTRA about how's this all going to play out with AI eventually. But at least for now, these are jobs that still require people here. And those jobs, again, if workers want to engage in collective bargaining and have the additional protections of labor law on top of employment law, the only way to get that is to get with your coworkers and form a union.
Well, and it's so interesting because so much of what the WGA and SAG is trying to fight for is protections against AI. And as you just said, tech workers and what jobs are going to be replaced by AI in finance. You know, I'm thinking about some of these finance bros who are not the people that you necessarily think that need that much protection. But like a lot of those like analyst type jobs can start being done by computers. And so it'll be interesting to see how much this new thing that could just replace people motivates people to actually be like, well, we need to be protected and keep our jobs.
Well, exactly. And I mean, don't get me wrong. There are professional, and we talked about in the public sector, obviously government workers. I mean, there used to be a very strong and large public sector union movement here in Wisconsin prior to Act 10, where everything from, prison guards, which you might think, okay, I can see why they would definitely benefit from having a union. But the accountants at the Department of Revenue in Wisconsin had a union, were formed a union. It was a major union. People, like you said, it's not, just people with hard hats or the people mm-hmm. in the construction trades. On the federal level, I mean, everybody from, the Transportation Safety Administration folks who you see, every time you go to the airport, but people like the passport processors that actually process your application, also professionals, but also work in an office and also have a union where they bargain collectively. So again, I think those are the jobs that are left in our economy. So those, as opposed to the industrial area of town, maybe it's in the research parks across Wisconsin where you're going to see the next surge of workers coming together to form unions.
Well, and also we only have a couple of minutes left, but it also seems like at least from what public polling I've seen about this is that the attitudes of the general public, whether or not they're in a union, are shifting to be more positive. And I feel like for a long time, unions got a bad rap. It was like Jimmy Hoffa type, unions, it's just there was this and again, maybe that's because of the media, but there was a less popular opinion of unions that seems to be having a resurgence. And do you think that's more because of David and Goliath stories, or because there is so much wealth that's accumulated at the top that there's a sense of fairness? But what do you kind of think as far as people even outside of actually doing the organizing, but just someone like me who's not in a union right now, is like, yeah, go get what's owed to you.
Well, I think we pick C, both A and B.
Okay,
I think that all of it plays into it in a different way, right? I mean, as workers hear about stories like the automakers trying to stand up and say, people doing the same work, and we saw this up in Sheboygan Falls with Kohler, right? Where, mm-hmm. They organized with their community partners and said, it's not right that people doing the exact same work now make a lot less money. And the company's profitable, so why couldn't they still make what we make? You saw it with the John Deere strikes across the Iowa plants and in Illinois, where it's the same argument, right? That the company is literally having record profits and you're coming to the workers for more concessions. How does this make sense? I think You know, you mentioned it. The Gallup poll is a great one because I love longitudinal data. And they've asked the exact same question, literally going back to the 30s. And you're right. Unions are at their highest popularity on that Gallup poll that they've been literally since the mid 60s. And I don't think you can undersell that the younger generation, as they learn more about it, say, why can't we have this at work?
This has been very interesting. Michael Childers is a professor at the UW-Madison Department of Labor Education and is a co-chair of the University of Wisconsin School for Workers. Thanks for joining us today. Back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinere. And people on August 30th, this month, will witness a super blue moon, the biggest and brightest moon of the year. According to NASA, the August super blue moon of 2023 is a rare phenomena, and people will not be able to witness it again anytime before 2037. So here to talk about what is a super blue moon is Milwaukee Public Museum Planetarium Director, Brooklyn Back, Bob Bonadour. How are you doing today, Bob? Oh.
That's very odd.
You sound like a cartoon character. You sound like a minion. We might have you call the line instead, 844-967-2789, because the sound is sounding a little
that's very
like
odd.
You like a VHS tape that got stuck in a trying to rewind it to put it back to Blockbuster.
In all the glitches that we've had over the year or so, this is a first.
This is a first. I have not heard that over the years, but Bob will call in and we'll get him. But Bob's come on, I think this is his third time that he's come on the show as far as helping us understand more of the celestial things that we were seeing in the sky. And so it was always fun to talk to Bob. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I must have been in another galaxy or something.
Yeah, apparently trying to beam in from the moon, and so from the super blue moon. And so how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Glad to be here with you and talk space.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a super moon, there's a blue moon, and there's a super blue moon. So let's go through all three of them and what they actually are.
All right. First off, super moon means the moon is a little closer in its orbit to planet Earth, meaning us, and it's about 7% bigger. It's not something you really notice, but the moon's orbit's not a perfect circle. It's elliptical. So, you know, a couple times a year, it's a little closer, and they call that a super moon. And the blue moon, right off, will not turn blue. It is simply an expression for the second full moon in the same month. And this happens about once every 3 years.
Got it. Okay. So this has nothing to do with my childhood favorite ice cream, Blue Moon from Babcock.
No.
No.
Or the beer.
So it's not blue. It's just, why did they choose to name it that if it has nothing to do with the color?
Well, it goes back hundreds of years ago. There's just an expression that someone must have just dreamt up and like, oh, that'll happen when the moon turns blue, and meaning it will never happen. So they kind of took that strange expression from long ago and just transferred it to something like that does happen, but not very often.
So it's about the rarity. It's about the rarity of it.
Yeah, it stems from the rarity of it because, you know, we get a full moon every month, right? And the month actually is a word that comes from the moon. They used to be called moons a long time ago. But some quirkiness with humans, and, you know, some months have 31 days, some have 30. And anyway, we can sneak a second full moon in once every 3 years.
Okay, but this one is saying what we're about to see. So the super blue moon of 2023, that's not going to happen again until 2037.
Yeah, well, it's just a coincidence having, you know, the super and the blue happen at the same time. So, yeah, it's about once every 18 years. But any full moon is beautiful to look at. You know, when it rises, it looks so big, and a lot of times it doesn't turn blue, but it turns that kind of yellowish-orange color, and that's due to the thickness of the atmosphere. But we'll have the harvest moon next month, and that will be another great full moon.
What I like about this one, Bob, on the 30th, is that I think I saw that it rises at like 9:32 p.m. So you can actually see it. You don't have to get up in the middle of the night, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning to go see the moon. You can actually look at it before you go to bed.
Oh, yeah. Any moonrise is lovely, or moonset, as many people out there know already. And so just look for the moon. Yeah, full moon means it rises at sunset and sets at sunrise. It's up all night.
Got it. Okay. So you just mentioned the harvest moon. I also went back. We had a strawberry moon in June. So, like, how many different categorizations of, like, moon sightings are there? Like, how many different types of moons, even though it's just one moon, do we have in general, I guess?
Well, there's plenty out there. A lot of, you know, long ago, people lived closer to nature, right? And they would name the full moons after things that were, you know, going on at that time. So the strawberry moon happens in June. That's when strawberries ripen. So thus it became the strawberry moon. And, of course, the harvest moon is when, you know, we bring in the harvest. And so the full moon, September, October, is the harvest moon.
So it's more us projecting things onto what's happening in our lives onto the moon versus something that's actually happening in space, like to the moon?
Precisely. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. We like to connect to the moon, to the cosmos. We love, you know, constellations. We're constantly trying to connect to the sky above us.
Absolutely. So it's happening. So the super blue moon is August 30th. You said that you can see it in the morning. Is there like a specific spot that's better than other places if you people want to be able to get the best view of it?
Just from home is great. Wherever you have a nice clear shot to the horizon, or just, you know, it will be up shortly after the sun goes down, and just look for it. And, you know, if you like to take pictures of it, just find your best place you like to do that and take a few pictures.
Bob, are there any superstitions associated with a super blue moon that you're aware of? Because it just seems like that would have been something that we would have attributed, you know, something to.
Well, we have a bucket load of superstitions with, you know, just the moon. I mean, tons of them. You know, the moon will make you act crazy and things like that. And people have said more babies are born on a full moon. And that's all just superstition. There's no scientific data to back any of that up.
Darn. wrap up the moon conversation, I'm having a baby in a month, and so I got my husband one of my childhood favorite books. Have you ever heard of Papa, please get me the moon for me? Have you heard of that childhood, that children's book?
No, not that one. I know many, but not that one. I assume it's a good one.
It's a good one, but it's like it pops up and there's one point where you could unfold the pages and it's the full moon. But it's like the premise, which is so unscientific. But as a kid, you don't know that is basically, you know, Papa's waiting for the moon to get small enough so he can go climb the ladder and bring it down for his daughter. He gives it to her and then it gets bigger and she has to put it back into the sky. But it was so funny because I like reading through it, because I gave it to my husband as a gift. And I was like, all I could think of was like our different conversations. Like, man, this is wildly inaccurate. Like, you're really spreading false information for these children.
Don't get me started.
I bet. And so, like, I bet there's a lot of children's books out there that are when it comes to space that you're like, nope, that's not right.
Oh, and I've read many, many books like that, and to my family, and of course, you know, watching a science fiction movie with me is sometimes not very fun because I'll point out all the inaccuracies of the movie. So
what movie's the most? What space movie's the most egregious to you, and the leaps that they take?
Well, I mean, Star Wars, Star Trek, they're always hopping around the galaxy in split seconds. And, you know, that just can't happen like they do it. But, you know, I guess it's a possibility. And, you know, don't get me wrong. These movies are fun. They're a lot of fun. But, you know, we're nowhere near how that. And a lot of it is strictly impossible. But it's okay. It's all fun.
It's okay.
We
it's
need
all
to
fun.
Imagine.
You and, I'm sorry, who's the astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson? You and Neil deGrasse Tyson must be a lot of fun to watch movies with, Bob.
Yeah, we try to keep our comments a little bit quiet. Yeah.
Speaking about bouncing around space, is there any new NASA news? There's something launching on Friday, right?
Yeah, we're continuously, you know, astronauts have been up there on the space station for, you know, 23 years straight. There's been people in space. Uh-huh. And four new astronauts are going up on Saturday with the SpaceX. And one American, one European, and one from Russia and one from Japan. So it's truly an international team going up this time. And then they'll dock with the space station and bring some other astronauts back. So that's always up there. And then we're going back to the moon. You may have heard NASA's going back to the moon. It won't happen for another 2-3 years. It's a program called Artemis, but we're going to have the first woman and the first person of color walk on the moon in 2 to 3 years.
That is very exciting. But speaking of moons, both India and Russia had some moon news this week too, right?
I saw that yesterday.
Yeah, Russia, no people, right, want to make that clear, but had a robot crash land on the moon, didn't make it, and then India is going to try and land a spacecraft on the moon, I think it is Wednesday, so... yeah, there's a lot of interest. You know, we're not the only ones. India, Japan, China has a big space program. So, yeah, we're all interested in space.
I just think it's so indicative, Bob, with these with this Russian accident over the weekend. We all like to think that this is all locked in and we know how to do this and we've done it before. And this is still really intrinsically dangerous stuff.
It's still a danger. These rockets are huge, and they have a lot more fuel than it's in your car, and it's moving a lot faster. I mean, you got to get these spaceships going. To leave the Earth, they have to go 7 miles per second. So think of how fast that is. Think of, you know, being home in 7 miles a second from your commute. That's an extremely fast speed and dangerous, and a lot of moving parts to make somebody go that fast. So, and then of course you got to slow down, right? So you're going that fast, then you got to slow down and get to where you want to go. So space travel still very dangerous. Of course, we've gotten a lot better, but there's still a lot of potential hazards.
When you phrase it like that, that you're moving 7 miles a second, now all I can envision is me 7 miles ahead of the rest of my hair, which is now behind me.
Yeah, it's crazy fast.
It's kind of unfathomable to like actually think, like wrap your head around how fast that is.
That your body can withstand that is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it's you know, think of the Earth's gravity. You know, we can only jump so high. Michael Jordan can only jump so high. Giannis Antetokounmpo, he can only jump so high. Gravity's always trying to pull us down. So to escape the Earth's gravity, you need to go 7 miles per second.
Wow. Wow. Well, we only have 2 minutes left, or less than 2 minutes left. So is there any new programs with school starting? Is there anything happening at the planetarium coming up that the public should know to go check out?
Oh, sure. We got two new things coming. We have a new show on eclipses called Lights Out, because eclipses go dark. And because we have a solar eclipse coming up in October and a big one coming up next April. And the other show we're opening, not really educational, but it has a lot of cool astronomy things. It's Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
Ooh.
On September 1st. So... if you're a Pink Floyd fan, come see us. It's going to play every day we're open, and we're going to do a big fun night on the last Saturday of the month. So check us out.
All right. Well, we will link to that in today's show notes. But Bob Bonadour is the Milwaukee Public Museum's Planetarium Director. Always so much fun to talk to you and learn about what's happening in the sky. Thanks for joining us today, Bob.
You're welcome. It's great to do, as always.
As always. All right. Thanks. Have a great day. We're going to take one more break and wrap up the show when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Speaking of bad analogies or bad cliches that are wildly inaccurate, the moon is much closer than all of the stars. And so I also think about that cheesy saying is like, shoot for the moon, because even if you miss, you'll be among the stars. Like, nope, you'll be a lot closer.
ruining science fiction films for everyone. Yes.
I know. I wonder what other like silly things like that Bob's just like, no, that's not how it works.
I love talking to him, though. He's so enthusiastic and so knowledgeable and just loves what he does, you know?
We love having people on who are very enthusiastic about what they do. I heard the Spoonbill conversation on Friday was very exciting.
It was so much fun, Kristen. And it sounds like such a silly thing, but David Drake was wonderful, and talking about this rare sighting of the roseate spoonbill that was seen around Green Bay at the beginning of August. And we talked about how that happens, because this is a bird that usually lives in Texas and Louisiana and Florida. So it's like, well, how did they just get blown off course? How does this even happen? And so he said it was the greatest explanation. He said, I always, because this was a younger bird, not a fully mature roseate spoonbill. And he said, okay, I always equate them to like 16-year-old drivers. And you're 16 years old and you're at a party and there are some egrets and some pelicans who seem like they're kind of fun and they're flying to Wisconsin. So you want to come along?
Oh my gosh.
And that's kind of how this happens, because they do travel with some other birds. And he said, yeah, they seem like a nice group. I'll go with them.
That's so funny.
Isn't that hilarious?
Well, there you go. That's hilarious.
And also a wonderful, if anybody is interested in this, and I'm displaying my age, but we were talking about birders and how birding has become such a big thing, especially since the pandemic. And there's this great app that he told us about that I downloaded over the weekend. It's called Merlin, Merlin, and it's put out by Cornell University. And they have all the birds in the world divided into sections, so you can download your section. And then if you're out in the yard or you're walking in the woods and you hear a bird you don't recognize, you can actually hold up your phone and it will.
So it's like Shazam for birds.
Yes, that's exactly what he said. It's really cool. So, yeah, I was doing that all weekend in my backyard. Ooh, what's this? I mean, I know what it is, but ooh, tell me.
Tell me. Let me see if you're right. Let me see if the technology is right. Well, that is very good. Well, thank you for covering for me on Friday.
Greg and I had a good time.
Everything went smoothly for people who were wondering. I got a call way earlier than I thought I was going to, as far as from Freighter saying he's out. Husband had back surgery on Friday, which is why I was out. He had his S1 and L5 basically had been rubbing against each other for years, and they finally went in and put a spacer in between them. So that all went well. But I would recommend, because the whole point of us doing this was because he had a lot of sciatic pain and stuff, and the whole point of doing it was before the baby gets here, because there is a lot of BLTs involved in child rearing and BLT is being bending, lifting and twisting. Yes. And so we're like, well, you should probably do this before the kid gets here. But the earliest they could get him in was 6 weeks before the baby's supposed to be here. And so this weekend of playing nurse, 8 months pregnant, and having to do, you know, like take out the garbage. Like he's looking at me being like, can't believe I'm having my like 8 month pregnant wife, like take out the garbage, like do everything around the house. He can't even pick up Cliff, our dog, who's only like 11 pounds because he can't lift more than 10 pounds. So he just kept looking at me and he was like, please don't go into labor this week. Like, please. I'm like, if I trust me, I'm trying to, I'll keep her in as long as I can. But it's also been funny because, so they went in through the front. So they did, it is anterior, which I think is a new, cause so now is he doesn't have any kind of cuts in his back, which is good. But his, as you can imagine, they have to move all of your organs and your abs like out of the way to reach your spine when they go in through the front. And what's been hilarious is because we have an ongoing riff with each other as far as who's funnier in our relationship, and he always is saying that he's the funny one, but now that it hurts for him to laugh, we're really seeing how much I do make him laugh because it's a little bit more pronounced than it usually is.
And so is this putting you ahead?
Funny.
Is this putting you ahead?
It's funny. It's making him realize that maybe I was a little funnier than he thought, because now it actually hurts him.
I was amazed how quickly he was standing.
Yeah.
They really don't they don't let you lay around much in the hospital anymore.
Well, I think because of blood clots, right? Like they want you up between the compression socks, but they want you up and moving and not letting things kind of just like
coagulate.
Lie still and coagulate. And so, but I think, you know, shout out to the hospital, to Frederick Hospital and to both surgeon, his vascular surgeon, Dr. Revel was his spinal surgeon. Dr. Rossi was his vascular surgeon. I got to meet both. They were very nice, but like, knocked it out of the park. And I think that's the thing of just watching. I mean, he's clearly uncomfortable, but just like how, I mean, that's like spinal surgery is no joke. And to see that he's, you know, up and each day getting a little bit better, and
it's remarkable,
like could be a, you know, 2.0 version of himself in a couple months, as far as his pain levels and his mobility levels and stuff like that. Like, it, modern medicine, man, it's impressive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, really glad to hear everything went well and that he's home and doing well. And soon he will be running faster and jumping higher than he ever thought possible.
Yeah. And soon he gets to take care of me in about 5 weeks. So exactly. We just get to swap places with him getting to do all the stuff around the house and me being the patient along with baby. So, but yeah, so everything is good there. Very excited to be back in, back on the show. Everything should be good this week. Speaking of stuff that coming up this week, Wednesday is a big day. Obviously, the Republican debate is coming to Milwaukee. Lots of news and lead up to that. But Civic Media is going to be on the ground in the Deer District by Fiserv. We will be recording from Deer District on Wednesday, starting with our show for the rest of the day. We will be at the Whitetail in the Deer District. We're going to have some really great collaborations with the Lincoln Project, some pregame coverage. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow. But thank you to Michael Childers for being here today. Thank you to Bob Bonadour. Thank you to everyone who called in and texted in. And just thanks for a great show. Another one in the bag. But we will be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. to do it all again. This has been As Goes Wisconsin.
Love you.